Okay, this is Endurance Corner Radio with Justin Dare, Alan Cousins, and Gordo Byrne. We're going to talk about altitude training, racing at altitude, some of the considerations for people who do not live at altitude that want to race at altitude. And finally, we'll discuss the new Ironman in Boulder and the course in a bit of detail and touch on some of the parts of the course of the Boulder 70.3 course as well. So in starting, we're basically going to go through altitude training in the traditional sense of what's often been discussed, why people are doing it, what's the best way to do it, what are some of the benefits, and also who and how to benefit the most from it. So Alan, I'll let you take over here. We do have some slides that will be seen on the website that you can follow along with this. And right now we're looking at slide 4 of 14. So that's where you'd be picking up if you were looking at it visually as well. So Alan, go ahead.
So let's start by just kind of chatting a little bit about what goes on when an athlete goes to altitude and what sort of adaptations they get there that are going to benefit them generally, whether they're racing at sea level or racing at altitude. The main kind of impetus for the positive stuff that we get from going to altitude comes from the fact that the partial pressure of oxygen up high is not as great as it is down low. And the effect that that has on the athlete is that their blood oxygen saturation is less than what it is down low. And we can actually measure that with a pulse oximeter and kind of quantify that. But basically that's what gets all of the good stuff happening, is the fact that the athlete no longer is carrying as much oxygen in their blood as what they were prior to going to altitude. And from that, the body decides, well, if we want to maintain functionality, we're going to have to do something here to get the same amount of oxygen transport. And so it releases this nice little hormone called EPO that some of you are probably familiar with for other reasons. And the EPO basically tells the body to produce more red blood cells that the athlete then has in their system, whether they're at altitude or for a period of time after returning to sea level. And that does a lot of really positive things for the athlete in terms of oxygen transport. So moving on to slide 5. As I was saying, some of you are probably familiar with this hormone for other reasons related to cycling of late. And I tweeted a little earlier in the week about the benefits to age group athletes of altitude training, of going up high. And it is really fairly obvious when we look at a sport like cycling, and the extent to which EPO use was being employed. It's ridiculously beneficial. And while altitude training doesn't carry the same magnitude of benefit, the mechanism is the same, and it makes sense for a lot of athletes who are serious about performance. So in terms of the magnitude, altitude training studies typically show a 2-5% bump to an athlete's hematocrit, which for those of you who are sort of familiar, it's significant.
And when you say 2-5%, what would be the time frame that might be seen?
So that would be over the course of sort of 3 to 4 weeks of an altitude camp. Yep. And most of the benefits are going to occur within that period of time. Acclimation isn't complete for about a year at altitude, but it's a exponential curve, and that first month a lot of the positive benefits occur.
Okay.
With that, related to that, I would say that what most people are going to find is that the training camp benefit dominates the altitude benefit. In other words, if you go to altitude and have poor training, you're much better off just doing a training camp where you have great training. And that's an important thing to remember. Altitude's not a magic tool. It's far better to make sure. I think one of the reasons why Boulder tends to work for people is it's such a great place to train, and you've got the access to different levels of altitude. I think that's a key thing for people to bear in mind.
Well, most altitude training locales are nice places to be. Weather's pleasant. The terrain is good. People are generally fit and highly motivated. So it's hard sometimes to tell what makes the altitude training camps as successful as they are. You know, if you were going to put, if North Dakota was at high altitude, no offense to you North Dakota folks out there, but would the training camps be as successful? Would the people be as excited to train there?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're all good points, you know, and it brings up a more general point that a lot of kind of researchers have looked at in terms of, you know, training intensity when you're at camp as well. And, you know, if you've got a bout of altitude sickness and you're feeling, you know, pretty horrible the whole time, then you're certainly not going to get the benefit from the camp that you might have if it had been a sea level camp, and, you know, you're able to feel good and train well throughout. So,
okay. All right, moving on to slide 6 of 14.
Yeah, so a lot of the research into altitude has been kind of focused on oxygen transport and VO2 max and short distance racing performance. But, you know, some of the research is starting to hint to the benefits of altitude training for long course athletes as well. And I've kind of outlined some of those on this slide. And you can check out the references as well. Improve mitochondrial function. So, you know, when you go to altitude, as I said, your body wants more oxygen delivery, and it wants to get more oxygen to the muscles. And one of the ways that it does that is to increase the function of the mitochondria within the muscle. Improve fat oxidation. So when you go to altitude, initially you will start to burn more carbohydrate. Your body will run more on glucose, but similar to the response to oxygen deprivation, eventually the body will supercompensate, and when you return to sea level, fat oxidation can actually be improved. So that's an important adaptation for long course athletes. And finally, economy, which I think is a really interesting one. There was a study done on elite runners that found about a 3% improvement in running economy, so decreased oxygen costs for a given run pace upon completing an altitude camp. So
in a practical term, you might say, if I'm running 8-minute miles at 150 heart rate,
right,
now I'm running at 145,
right,
or something like that.
Which, you know, when you translate it to the Ironman, you know, every beat is material. So yeah, as you know, bottom line of that slide is there is benefit to Ironman athletes in addition to short course athletes who have been the focus of a lot of the studies of altitude training.
Okay, slide 7 of 14.
But, and here's the big but, the benefits of altitude training are transient. So when you return to sea level, your body realizes I've got more oxygen transport than I need for my normal function. And if you don't capitalize on that, either through a harder training block or through a race, it will revert to your normal normal O2 carrying capacity for sea level. So I think that's an important thing for athletes to consider with the timing of altitude camps.
Mm-hmm. So along those notes, a couple years ago, I was with Jason Kask, who he does something in cross-country skiing now. At the time, he was working at USAT at the Olympic Center. And he came down to a camp that I was attending for some other athletes and was talking about some of the things that they have been observing, particularly now that there's permanent altitude residence going on, not simply camps. You know, permanent residence in Mammoth, permanent residence in Park City. They were saying that most people that were simply using altitude as a camp benefit, either they were seeing their best racing within 1 week or more than two. And there was like a gray area between the 7 and 14. On the flip side, they were finding that people that permanently lived at altitude, it was less significant when they were dropping down. I don't know why that would be necessarily, why I wouldn't apply the same. I'm just saying that that was their, what they had been observing in the time frame that they've been spending more and more time permanently at altitude versus camp-wise.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I have seen studies that have shown that repeated exposure to altitude improves the person's tolerance to altitude. So I guess it's that sort of chronic versus acute adaptations, and you know, you get those the more you go up. So yeah, in terms of kind of quantifying how long those adaptations hang around, there's a neat chart there from a study that was done in 2008 that shows how hemoglobin decreases upon return to sea level. And you can see for that first 2 weeks, it's actually interesting what you said. You know, there seems to be a bit of a dip there in that first week, and then the second week the hemoglobin mass is as good as it was upon return to sea level, and then from that 2 week point on, it sort of starts to dip off pretty markedly.
Yeah, and I know. I've always wondered myself if in the time period that you drop down, you know, if you were to drop down in a 2 week period, whether the training that you all of a sudden do is now all of a sudden at a higher intensity than you've been accustomed to, and so you just get tired. Like you don't necessarily think that you're tired because maybe your heart rate isn't that high, or you know, all the things are, but now all of a sudden everything is 5 or 7% higher, and you know, you race 2 weeks in and you're just a little flat from having done everything a little bit harder than you would have done at home.
Yeah.
So maybe when you're 3 or 4 weeks down the line, people race well in that time frame because they've had time to adapt to the new sort of load on their muscles versus when they first got down.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And you know, I think that's the way that a lot of elite athletes typically play the camps, is it's a lead into the final sort of sharpening phase of training. And you know, that'll enables them to sort of stabilize some of those adaptations that that occur up high.
And when, Gordo, when would you usually drop down?
Well, I think you need to consider how you're using altitude in the overall approach. In other words, I'm a big believer in the live at altitude or spend a whole summer up there, and I think that lets you really benefit from the training. And for half Ironman and Ironman racing, after you've done that initial adaptation, there's no training cost in terms of pace or power. You're at a sea level work rate, so you can do your work rate training. Whereas if you were a sprint distance athlete, there is an argument that you would actually need to go down and do sea level training camps to do your VO2 work and your really fast work. So if you're thinking about coming down for a race, I would say think about the recovery component. Where are you going to recover the best? Now, some people, they're going to recover just by getting down to sea level, a cool place. You know, if you think about, my favorite place to recover is like Northern California, near the ocean. It's a great place. So if you were racing, you know, Bay Area type thing, and you were looking to recover from altitude, you go back down to sea level and you're going to recover really quickly there. Some other people, for instance, top elites, if they go somewhere, there's so many distractions and sponsor commitments and media commitments, they actually are going to recover better just staying at home until the last minute. Then they turn up, they don't get completely stressed out in the venue. So you really have to be thinking more, where am I going to recover, rather than trying to optimize your hematocrit. That's one piece of the overall recovery picture. Now, what I found worked best for me was go out the weekend before the race, because I could have a really calm race week leading into the Ironman. My main Ironman would be Ironman Canada, and I would continue to stay. That's an old one. I would continue to stay at altitude when I was in Penticton. I would actually be up at the ski area, and I'd be sleeping up there at night because that was the altitude that I had adjusted to. And it was really cool up there and quiet, and I'd just kind of go down during the day. And the benefit that I saw was two things. A slower fatigue rate, so I would have much better stamina over duration, and then much quicker recovery from rollers, surges, different things like that. So in a tactical race, I felt like I would recover much quicker. And that was the key benefit that I felt. But I never used altitude to try and drop down and do a bike race. Where I've done is I've done some extreme kind of altitude racing, which would be Leadville, which is very high, and that's completely different. You come to sea level, you don't have any mental capacity about appropriate pacing, and that's what can throw you out. So we can talk about that a bit later. Okay.
Next slide, 8 of 14.
So, one of the big questions that we sort of get from, particularly from age group athletes who, typically have a normal work schedule and normal holidays and those sorts of things and can only be away from, from work for a week or 2 weeks at the most, is how long do I need to do an altitude camp in order for it to be worthwhile? And I don't have any terribly great news for you guys here. The research does tend to focus around that 3 week mark, at least for altitudes that we would use. The higher you go, you can get benefit with shorter periods of time, but you can't train at 14,000 feet. So the sort of altitudes that we typically use for camps. 3 weeks at a minimum for continuous exposure is what researchers have tended to find to get those positive benefits.
And just on that, what I would say is, if we're trying to make it real for people, the way to play it is if you Google Gordo Core Block Ironman, my Core Block workout will come up for you. And that's a broken Ironman over a long weekend or a three-day camp. And if you're thinking about doing the, train and live at sea level, race at moderate altitude, which would be Tahoe or Boulder, then what you do is you're much better off recognizing the fact you're not going to be able to train at altitude. And somewhere in that 3 to 7 weeks before the event, you do yourself a mini camp, and you go to altitude and you do those race simulation workouts, and you see how it's going to impact you on the course. And it'll be incredibly valuable because you're going to make some mistakes, but you can learn from them. As well, the impact of your pacing mistakes will be obvious to you. In other words, you don't want to find out that redlining on the bike is a bad idea on race day. Because one of the things that altitude will do to you is it'll accentuate your errors. Similar to, say, a really hot race. If you make a pacing mistake, it's much tougher to come back from it. And there's different reasons for that. I think AC's point about the carbohydrate usage, I think people that are maybe a little heavy on the accelerator, they deplete themselves much more rapidly than they're used to. And a core block weekend, a bunch of long sims will really point that out to you. And then you can adjust your approach.
Interestingly enough, Endurance Corner actually has a camp 6 weeks out from Ironman Boulder.
No.
It does just that.
Yeah.
No, but in all seriousness, I think being able to make mistakes and blow up before the big day, regardless of whether it's at altitude or somewhere else, is always very educational and worth your time.
It's very hard to predict. Everyone's very individual in how they respond to altitude. So it's the sort of thing that you can't send me an email and ask me, how am I going to respond to altitude? The only way you're going to know that is if you put yourself at altitude and test some things.
I think you can, there's hints in how you run in your races. If you tend to fade on the run, with your sea level races, you're going to get punished. because it means you've got some pacing issues. If you always like to be at the front of when you're with people, altitude can accentuate the impact of those types of decisions. I think it just sort of makes things bigger.
Yeah.
What I tell people is when they're asking me, look, I got X days, I say, go to where you're going to do the best training. Do your training, and then go home and recover. Get back, get yourself kind of out of the loop. If somebody has a whole summer and they got a couple months at altitude, well, then the nice thing is you can actually taper the athlete in, do two training cycles, and then they can go hit the road. And you can get a big benefit from, say, a six-week camp. I think you can get a material benefit.
Yeah.
But I still think the training camp effect dominates. And I also think that some of the benefits to altitude are hidden. They don't necessarily turn up in your red blood cell mass. So you can be getting a biochemistry benefit that you don't necessarily see in a blood test.
Yeah, and that's sort of what I was hinting at with the metabolic changes too. You know, that's an area that hasn't been researched to the same extent as some of the blood markers, but, you know, all signs point to a pretty substantial effect there in terms of improving fat burning, which is obviously a big adaptation for...
Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes when you train at altitude a lot, you're always sort of searching for the easiest way to get something done. Like, you don't want to... Yeah. You improve economy because you don't want to waste any energy,
yeah,
because you're already limited on the amount that you have.
Absolutely.
And so I think when you drop down and all of a sudden you don't have that factor, even if it's just a kinesthetic thing, the way things feel to you, it feels better,
yeah,
than it might have felt, regardless of what's going on physiologically.
Yeah, absolutely. Just adding on that, the duration question, one of the ways we can kind of put in a bit of a cheat, I guess, is with the use of things like tents. I think the use of tents, the benefit comes down, again, a lot to the individual. Some people just don't recover and don't sleep well in tents, and obviously it depends on your setup and that sort of thing. But
so while we're on that tents, because I think the main benefit of tents is training your brain to fall asleep in a low oxygen environment. And what it means is you go to altitude and you can sleep, so
yep,
you can recover, because the most common thing reported when people turn up at altitude is disrupted sleep. Because they turn up at altitude, their training load goes up, they can't sleep, and then it's just a ticking time bomb. You got 5 to 6 days to do what you need to do, and then your lack of recovery is going to sink you. So for people that need to perform at altitude, quite often, if you use a bit of the tent stuff and you get yourself used to sleeping at that altitude, you're going to recover quicker. I don't necessarily think it's a magic thing like, you know, I'm using the tent so that I'm going to be rocking at sea level. I don't think so. I think you're using it so that you can, if you're going to altitude, you can benefit. And then when you talk to mountaineers that you're using extreme altitude, that is what the tent kind of gives them. They can ramp in a little quicker, and they don't get run down as quickly once they're up there. Now, again, some people say they swear by the tent, but again, because of the placebo effect, pretty much you give anybody anything, half of them are going to think it's great if they really believe in it.
Yeah.
But that's the biggie. I think you might be able to sleep. The other thing is, don't go crazy with it. If you're using artificial altitude or using real altitude, you got to remember it's a big shock to your system, and ultimately you need to do your training. So, for instance, you know, coming to Boulder 5,500 feet, we would call that, you know, low to moderate altitude. It's not necessarily better to go to Vail or Winter Park over 8,000. Your sleep's going to be really disrupted if you're coming up from sea level. You just won't be able to train. And, you know, after four, maybe 5 days, you're going to either get sick or your training will sort of tail off.
And, you know, for those athletes who have access to the tents, I think, as Gordo said, it's a really useful way to taper into an altitude camp. So, you know, if you don't have the 3 weeks and you've only got a week or two, a tent leading into that kind of mini camp can be a really good way to play things.
Okay, next slide.
So, next slide. We're on slide 9 of 14. So, moving on to some of the guidelines as far as elevation goes, you know, what we find is most beneficial in terms of the where you want to locate yourself. Again, the studies have been pretty definitive on a minimum altitude to get good response in some of those blood markers. And, you know, 2,200, 2,500 meters or, you know, 7,000 plus feet has been kind of the number that keeps cropping up in terms of getting good hematological response, which is, you know, one of the reasons that we tend to see the high altitude centers in the U.S. in places like Flagstaff and Mammoth Lake, Santa Fe, Park City, which are all in and around that altitude.
And just on this, one way that people can benchmark it is, I think, you know, if you're really serious about this, spending just a little bit of money getting yourself a pulse oximeter to see what's going on with your blood in terms of your oxygen saturation and looking at, you know, are you desaturating, and also seeing, you can track that as well in the morning, your waking saturation as opposed in addition to your waking heart rate, to see if you're getting smashed. Because one of the things you'll see is if you're hitting it too hard on the training side, you're going to stop recovering, your OSATs are going to start falling, and you'll see a downward trend each morning as you're fatiguing. And one of the things you'll see, I'm a high responder to altitude, so I wake up relative to my peers at a training camp, my OSATs are lower. They almost look like I'm sick. So you have to look at how your body's responding and also how your training's responding. If you're starting to feel tired, you're starting to see the OSATs go down, odds are you don't want to pile on the stress. Likewise, you got a big day planned, OSATs are good, resting heart rate is normal, you know you can hit it. The other thing too is, one of the things I found living and training in Boulder is there's kind of a sweet spot, and it mirrors what Alan's got on the slide. I found that kind of, say, 6,500 feet to 8,500 feet. We use that altitude a lot here. And what do we use it for? We use it for fartlek running, tempo running, uphill, moderately hard, tempo, you know, whatever you want to call it. It's that sub-functional threshold type effort. And you can do a lot of that work at a, you know, you're desaturated, so you're getting a good dose of training, and you're also getting a good dose of desaturation. And then we're coming under 6,000 feet, a little bit under 6,000 feet, which is enough for us, you know, cool nights, enough for us to get a great recovery after that type of work. And for half Ironman, Ironman, and also for your intensive endurance training, even as a short course athlete, it's a great zone that can be used. And if you get fried, you can kind of recover here if you're here for a summer. Whereas if you get really fried at 8,000, it's tough to bounce back from burying yourself.
And that was a great point, too, on looking at the O2 sats. I mean, whenever we give guidelines for elevation, you've got to remember that one athlete's sats at 7,000 feet might be 95, and other athletes might be 80, 88, 89, you know, so there can be a lot of individual variation at various altitudes. And if you know your own response and you know what altitude gets you into that sort of sweet spot of the low 90s, then you can plan training camps accordingly.
And the Kiwis will go to 4,000 feet and they'll be doing track sessions on Nordic ski trails.
Mm-hmm.
And the coaches are sitting there at the end of each repeat and they want to see heart rate and OSATs. And it's like, is our pace getting the desired, well, first, what's your pace?
Yeah.
Are we getting the desired intensity? And combined with that, are we getting the desired desaturation? And for some athletes, particularly athletes that can really rev it high and go fast, you can have an altitude training camp of 4,000 feet.
You can have, I mean, for a lot of athletes, we'll see at VO2 max at sea level, we'll desaturate below 95%. So, you know, they're the athletes who typically struggle when they go up to high elevations because, you know, by the time they get up high, they're well and truly in the 80s and they're struggling to just kind of just survive, you know. So, yeah, I think it's really important, and it's a worthwhile investment if you are going to use altitude training.
One other point while we're still on this kind of altitude in the different zones. If you are an athlete, and I'll just toss it in because I know a lot of Ironman people kind of think about doing Leadville. If you're thinking about trying to perform at extreme altitude, I think the more times you can touch 11,000, 12,000, the better. And I think that's an interesting metric, because one of the things I found was every time I went really high, it got that little bit easier. And no matter how fit I was, I'm training at Boulder, I'm living at altitude, I'm getting up to 9,000 feet year round. There's a big shift that happens, as Alan says in the slide, at that 10,000 point. There's a clear change. Something happens. Yeah. I really struggle to sleep. The fatigue generated from time at or over 10,000 just feels different in me. And the more times I get up there, even just training easy and hanging out, the better. And I'll just put that out there.
Yeah, I mean, and you see that a lot with some of these locations, too. They have those options, you know, where you can go up and touch higher altitudes, but then come down a little bit to recover, do faster work, or just sleep, you know. So,
for people that are sort of, if you're thinking about racing Tahoe, you're thinking about racing Boulder, or you even want to use an altitude training camp to enhance your sea level, I would say stay under 9,000. You don't need to be using the extreme stuff. You're going to give away too much in recovery and pace to make it worth your while. You don't need to be going that high. I mean, you look at the people, the really fast people around here, they're not going over 9. Okie dokie.
All right, next slide, 10 and 14.
So some of the risks, the drawbacks of altitude training. The first line relates to the concept of responders and non-responders to altitude, which is something that the guru of altitude research, Levine, has kind of suggested. Some people just don't adapt to altitude.
So if you're saying
something in there,
yeah,
on that, and I've found if you're an athlete that has smaller lean body mass. And you tend to run higher reps, so it's a smaller engine running hot. I think you can be a slow responder, because the effect of altitude, the impact of that little bit of desaturation you're going to get, you're going to really feel it.
Yeah.
Big diesel, large athlete, you're not running that engine at as high RPMs. So you'd be the type of athlete that would have a pretty low heart rate when riding on the flat. Strong, that athlete will be a much quicker responder, typically just by their physiology and the nature of their training. And I think when you're talking about the slow responder, the non-responder, what it means is to get the benefit altitude, you're going to have to hang out for a while, and you're going to have to train easy for a while, so you're giving away all that training load. And for most people, the time to give away load is not 4 to 7 weeks out from your race.
Yeah.
It's not worth the trade.
And that was that point by some slides that you had shared with me from the altitude conference, where Terrence Mann was talking about that, and about how the people who have a hard time responding to altitude, or the slow responders, he cycles them more, you know, has them coming down doing harder blocks and then going back up, whereas those who are handling and can do their tempo stuff up high, it's not such an issue.
Mm-hmm. But in saying that somebody responds or doesn't respond, I mean, how long would you need to wait to know if you're responding? In other words, would you be measuring hematocrit, on a weekly basis, or would you need to complete the camp and come down, because there are effects on hematocrit just based on, when you work out a lot, you it goes down some, so maybe it would have been down further. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so,
you're typically not going to see the benefit until you've done the camp,
yeah.
Right?
So maybe the first time you'd just be taking your chances, and then. But would you say that if you weren't seeing any response, that it might be worth going higher?
And that's the thing, I think that the whole responder non-responder classification has more to do with the fact that. In those studies, they were looking at a narrow range of altitude, and some people, it was enough for them.
Yeah.
Some people, it was too much for them.
So that's a great point.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when I came, Molina had me, I went straight to Sugarloaf, which is actually above Boulder. So I Hong Kong, did a race in California, came up here, went to, what's Sugarloaf? It's going to be about 7,000 probably, 1,500, Sugarloaf Mountain up there.
It's like 9,000.
No, it wasn't at 9, though. I was probably
just somewhere up there.
Probably about
7. Yeah, okay, whatever.
Seven,
higher
seven,
than
five.
Here.
Right.
And again, it was enough. It was enough for me.
Yeah.
Likewise, some folks, they could go to four.
Yeah.
Might be enough for them. That's a great one. The way you figure it out is you got to just go and do it. I agree. I think you're gonna learn what works, what doesn't work. You're also gonna learn the sessions that can kill you. I think Bobby McGee likes saying, you got to really be careful with workouts like Magnolia Road, you know, which is a run that people do around here from about 7,500 to 8,500 feet. Because if you're really fit, you can do a lot of damage at those moderately high altitudes.
Yeah, and that's where, and again, you know, it's complicated because it's complicated sort of thing. It, you know, you'll get a lot of different numbers if you have a group of athletes, if you look at their O2 sats from a given workout at a given elevation. So it's a really useful thing to do if you do go to altitude to get one of those and see how it changes with intensity as well. If you do a tempo run, are you like crazy desaturated at the point that it's really
much? Just a recap on what crazy would be. So pretty much anything under 90?
Yeah, I think in terms of kind of that sweet spot of performance and adequate altitude stimulus, low 90s is where you want to be.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think for those of you that are using tents and other things, it's worth doing a little research on your OSATs, because you definitely don't want to crank your tent so high you run the risk of making yourself sick or screwing up your recovery because your oxygen saturation is too low.
That's always the temptation, and that, you know, the tent will go up to 14,000. You.
Well, as Melina says, you give a triathlete a tool, they're going to overuse it. So you got to be smart with it. Okay.
All right, next slide, 11 of 14.
So, yeah, we've kind of talked about the recovery concerns for more anaerobic athletes. I mean, I can't look at that line without thinking about Petro. And
that's a shout out to you, buddy.
Yeah, if you're somebody, you know, if you're a very powerful athlete that's great with sprints and short duration efforts, you can do a lot of damage to yourself by repeatedly tapping your anaerobic fitness at altitude. We saw you can actually make yourself fairly sick. I think the other thing is to get the most out of altitude. One of the things we saw, we had our team doc, Jeff Schilt, spend a summer with us in Colorado, and he didn't get his blood work done until after the summer, and then he found out that he was depleted in terms of his iron stores. So if you're thinking about going to altitude or spending a big block in altitude, go see your healthcare provider, get your blood work done, and talk about where you're at in terms of your iron levels, your red blood cell levels, how your overall fitness is looking. Do not supplement iron on your own without the blood tests and without the supervision of your healthcare provider. But it may be appropriate to get the benefit of altitude to make sure you're not depleted going in.
That's absolutely critical. You know, we spent a little bit of time at the Olympic Training Center, and that was something that was really hit home by Randy Wilber, the physiologist down there. All of the athletes were having their blood work done very frequently. I think it was every 6 weeks while they were at Colorado Springs, which is 6,500 or thereabouts.
Yeah.
Super important. You need, if you want to adapt from the training, if you're putting the money into altitude training or tents or anything, you need to make sure that you've got...
You probably want to be checking that ideally, say, 6 to 8 weeks out. So you can have time, if you need to make an adjustment, if you need to supplement, you can have time to absorb what you're gonna put into yourself. All right?
And, finally, one of the things to consider for athletes who do need to preserve some of that top end, or athletes who have no top end but want some, is look at what sort of a gap you see between the efforts you're able to put out at altitude and your sea level efforts. And if there is a large gap there, then you're probably going to want to cycle more frequently, and you might not be the sort of athlete who's going to benefit from extended stays at altitude.
And again, I think for most of the people listening, that's a fact, but half Ironman, Ironman, you're not going to be limited by your anaerobic fitness and power. That's actually going to be something that might be better trained at home before you come, because you're going to be focused more race-oriented probably when you're here.
All right, next slide, 12 of 14.
So now we're talking, we're sort of moving on to racing at altitude.
Yeah, so we're going to, so let's start by talking about a little bit about, you know, even if you were acclimated.
Yeah.
So if you came here for 3 to 4 weeks before a race and you're fully acclimated, what would you still see relative to what you might see at sea level?
So Boulder, we're, what, 5,300?
Yeah, but you'd be racing between 5,000 and maybe almost 6,000 the whole day.
Yep. So, unacclimated, there's a good rule of thumb here that you can kind of commit to memory. Expect a 2% reduction in VO2 max and in your aerobic numbers for every 1,000 feet after the first. So, Boulder, that would put us at 8 to 10% for the non-acclimated athlete reduction off their sea level numbers. Acclimated, you can expect about half of that if you're fully acclimated. So, we're still expecting a 4 to 5% reduction compared to sea level.
I always think of if you're acclimated, it's like a percent per thousand or something. If you're at 5,000 feet, you'd be at 5% or something like that.
Just to confuse the situation a little though, your air's thinner. So for a race where you're moving at high speed on the bike, you can be a lot faster in Boulder.
Which is why you see good times.
You see the elites absolutely rocket here. Because whatever they're giving away, they're getting it in reduced, what would you call it, wind resistance.
Yeah, I mean, I think when Tony Rominger set the hour record, I think it was ninth. Yeah, it was up there.
So, something to bear in mind. So I think what we're going to see when we have this Boulder Ironman is a similar thing. We're going to see a lot of people go really fast because it's not high enough for the altitude to dominate the benefit you get on the bike.
Yeah.
So that's good. The other thing that I've found is on the aerobic numbers. So what the submax, so steady, mod, hard, you can get fit enough so that you don't really notice it. You might notice functional threshold, but again, how often is a middle distance or long distance triathlete doing that real maximal stuff where you would notice the gap? Not very often. So you can go, you don't really see it once you adjust.
And I think honestly that's one of the dangers for folks coming in, is that in an RPE sense, you're not going to feel a whole lot different when you're riding at steady watts from sea level to steady watts here. But the metabolic changes.
And that's slide 13. That was a great point. I think that's, why don't you take it?
Yeah. So now we're looking at slide 13 of 14.
So, related to Gordo's point, even though, your steady feels steady, it's important to realize that your metabolic profile at altitude is probably going to be significantly different to what it is at sea level. And it's very common when we do altitude camps for athletes to experience a bonk at some point during the camp, even if they're typically bonk-proof at home. And that relates to that. It's pretty substantial. There's been some studies that have shown a 5% increase in carbohydrate oxidation for every 1,000 feet. So, if you do the math, you're burning 20% plus more carbohydrate in Boulder than what you were on the flat. So if your fuel stores last you, 7 hours in your normal training day at home, just be aware that might be, 4 or 5 hours here. And I think that's something you want to take into consideration.
Definitely.
Well, I think that's where coming out for a few days can really let you see what's up. If pay attention to how you race at sea level. If you're somebody that tends to fade late, you got to really watch your spikes on the bike. And you've got to be calm. You got to really pay attention to heart rate stress, because what that's going to show you is, first off, you're not going to be digesting and processing as well as you might.
Yeah.
And then also that's a hint that you're running hot in terms of your fuel usage.
And that's one of the things that these studies have consistently shown, is that heart rate is a great indicator of what's going on metabolically. So, a really typical scenario is an athlete comes to altitude, they're pushing their steady watts, 200 watts or whatever that they normally do back home, and their heart rate's 10 or 15 beats higher, and they're like, oh, I'm at altitude, that's to be expected, you know, it's no big deal sort of thing. But that is a good indication that metabolically that difference is occurring and you're burning that much more carbohydrate, you know, it's a good litmus test, I guess.
Ironman's one heck of a long tempo workout if you're not used to it. That's true. I mean, that's what the elites are doing,
yeah.
But they train to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
All right, last slide.
So take-home points, where possible, acclimatize, you know, and that's something that obviously is a function of what's realistic for you.
So with the introduction of a couple Ironmans at what would be sort of moderate altitude, 5,500, 6,500, and the Boulder 70.3, and now Tahoe has a half Ironman, and I know there's some other races in Flagstaff and that sort of thing, so... If somebody could, say they do not live at altitude, but they did have the ability to maybe fully acclimatize within the sense of 3 to 4 weeks, if they came here to do that, when would they actually start to do some simulation work where they could get an idea of what to expect on race day? I mean, how would you think they could incorporate that in effectively with the time frame that they're given?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a period of time where training is going to be compromised if an athlete is doing that four-week block. You can't expect to come to town and be hitting it right from the get-go. You know, typically the way they're structured, the second and third weeks are kind of the heaviest weeks of those sort of blocks. And, you know, I think that kind of second weekend for an athlete who has that period of time is a really good time to do key workouts.
Okay. And...
Other thing I would say is don't do the normal visitor thing, which is get off the plane and ride to the Continental Divide, because, you know, stay down if you're coming out.
Yeah.
There's no hurry to go high. Just hang out in town. It's plenty high.
Now, most people, when they come to these races, will come 3 to 4 days out. Some might have the ability to come maybe the weekend before. That might be a more viable option for a lot of people, which in a race like both Tahoe and Boulder are both on Sundays, so let's say you could get there 9 to 10 days out in that time frame. Is there anything, you know, that they should do in that time frame that might be optimal for race day, and are there things they shouldn't do in that time frame?
Okay, I got one. Number one thing, practice your swim start. Because I can remember my first sea level Ironman swim start, and you're nervous, you're jacked up, I totally buried myself. Okay, let's move me 5,000 feet higher and bury myself, and it's really stressful on the body, and that's no way to start a long day. So get used to swimming with people. They do open water workouts here in Boulder. Most places will have open water workouts. We've built a swim race into our camp for people to really check that out. What's the start going to be like? Because it's easy to make a mistake and it's unnecessary. So you got to get that in your head. You got to get how easy is easy for the start. And for most of us, I remember when I was starting out, it had to be really easy because I was so excited.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that goes for the bike as well. You know, as Gordo had said before, those spikes are really costly. So, you know, if you can get out and you can sort of recalibrate your power to heart rate, you can get a couple of files and you can see, okay, this is how I normally ride, but my heart rate's 10 beats higher here. You can start to get a sense of how you have to ride during the race in order to keep those heart rate numbers fairly normal.
Yeah, it's 5 miles gradually uphill at the beginning too, so don't panic. I think it's a really slow start when you do that race. What?
We'll get to that later.
Oh,
yeah. So, in finally, let's say somebody doesn't get the chance to come here early and do some simulation work. They're showing up. Race is Sunday. It's Thursday. How would you suggest that they approach their pacing and what they should be doing in that 48 hours that they have here?
Yeah, don't ignore your heart rate. That would be the main thing that
so
I
that,
would
that's
say.
That's basically the equalizer that you have on how everything is affecting you while you're out there without having had any other previous feedback to look at either.
That's right. And, you know, there's differences. You know, some athletes, you know, may be able to pull out a a slightly higher heart rate if they're really metabolically acclimated to doing it. But, you know, presuming that you haven't had those camps and you haven't had the chance to do that, the heart rate is a really good indicator of stress on the body.
Okay, so now we're going to start to go over the Ironman Boulder course and what's coming up this year. So the Ironman Boulder course, the swim takes place in the reservoir. It'll be a one-loop swim. It sort of goes into a northeasterly direction to try to... The sun glare out there is bad. If you have to head directly east, you can't see a thing because most of the mornings are clear here and there's nothing on the horizon to block it. You're just looking at Kansas. So with that in mind, they changed the Boulder 70.3 course last year to go in that direction, and it is quite a bit better. You can see a little bit better, but one loop course. Like Gordo said earlier, watching your swim start is pretty key at altitude. I'm not sure if they're doing a rolling start or a mass start, so probably have to check on the website to see what it is that they decide.
Tinted goggles.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tinted goggles would probably be very helpful there. In heading out onto the course, you have about a mile or two to get out of the main road that goes into the reservoir, and then you're dealing with sort of a false flat of maybe 4 to 5 miles along J Road and then eventually 28th or Highway 36. And this will be slow. If you are going really hard, it is still slow. And so when you combine the eagerness early in a race with the fact that you're traveling really slowly and then you're surrounded by a bunch of people that are hammering and you're at altitude, that's while not a particularly long section, it will probably be a very key section to not want to blow yourself up too much. From there, you head along Highway 36, which is rolling terrain, but it will be a net loss all the way to Highway 66. And then from there, you were going to make your way north over to Carter Lake, but as of last week, they cut it out of the course. So now you're not really dealing with a major elevation change in one go. There are some gradual climbs and some rollers on the north side of the course, but not as significant as Carter Lake would have been. So basically, you're going to get some variations, but nothing too technical and too difficult from a pure terrain elevation incline standpoint, at least if you're from Colorado. You know, maybe if you're from South Florida, then maybe some significant rollers. Then the main part of the course, which really doesn't get talked about as much, is you're going to head east and get on the other side of I-25, and you get on these two long sections that run south and go through sort of farmland and oil country, basically. And there are a few significant rollers that are sort of mini climbs, particularly as you turn south onto Colorado Road. You're going to go down this little valley, and you go up a really big, well, we would probably call it roller, but it's really like a short climb. As long as you don't go too crazy there, there's nothing you can't get up. It's sort of a moderate effort. From there, you're heading through the cornfields and oil fields and all that for quite a long period of time before eventually making your way back west. Now, having done this route a lot in the springtime, the winds were never favorable, and it was always awful. So
when you say not favorable, what do you mean? They were coming
southwesterly.
From southwesterly.
Southwesterly, okay. Which is not typically the direction in the summer. In the summer, they tend to be more favorable. But I'm just saying.
You can get a day where you just rock heading south.
Yeah.
Because it's quartering.
Right.
So even when you're passing people, you're still getting the tailwind. You're never in the shelter. Mm-hmm. So it's just fantastic if you get one of those days. The bike splits will be super fast.
Yeah. I really think, if you see the predictions and there's anything that says south or west to the wind forecast, you really, really want to be saving your energy for the backside of the course.
Yeah.
Because you're going to fly through the front side, and when you do courses that have a very fast front end and then you get the back half, not only the back half of races are always difficult, but then when you add to the fact that you have a headwind, so you have to actually ride harder, but you also actually have to feel slower. It's not, you know, it can be not that fun. So look at the wind predictions, be ready. If you have less than favorable winds on the backside, be prepared to be, you know, sort of physically and mentally strong in that section. Now, as you make your way back towards town, you go on Highway 52, which has some nice rollers. You'll turn left on, basically, you'll come down a steep descent on Highway 52, and just as you're getting all your momentum up, they'll take it all away and send you up this big hill. And it sort of stair steps. You keep thinking you're at the top, so that could be one that's sort of close to town. Maybe you drive it just to see.
It's a real deal pitch, too.
Yeah.
You're sort of, you're 4 watts per kilo just to get up
there. Yeah. So I would, you might want to get a good mental picture of that. Then that'll eventually bring you back to J Road, and then as you head back into Boulder, you're going to be faced with a similar thing of what you were dealing with at the beginning, where you're on sort of a gradual rise the whole time. So it definitely drags, maybe more than you want it to again. But just remember that pretty much any time you head west, you're gaining elevation. Anytime you head east, you're probably losing it. So keep that in mind. If you're heading towards the mountains, you're going up. If you're going away from them, you're going down a bit. Coming into town, you're going to go down Folsom and end up in close to downtown Boulder at T2, and then the run will begin, which is done entirely on the Boulder Creek path or some of the split-offs from it. You're going to begin by running down creek, so you could definitely blast yourself running very quickly on an all-concrete run going to the east. And then, because the transition area is sort of splitting the run course, you're going to get maybe 2/3 of one direction downhill, but then you got to do a whole half of the run course straight uphill. And the pitches get steeper as you go more west. As you get closer to the mountains, the pitch of the Boulder Creek path goes from maybe a moderate incline that you might not quite know is going uphill to you definitely know, okay, now I'm running uphill. And it's going to require you to do that. Obviously, you're doing two loops, so on the second time around, you're going to have this section of the run that's taking place from probably, you know, mile 15 to 23 or somewhere in that stretch that is, you know, uphill when it's already a difficult portion of the race, and you're at altitude, so, you know, probably be feeling more of the effects at that point in time. So it's definitely going to be a little bit different of a race in the sense that dialing into one specific pace or something like that, there's going to be, won't totally work. You're going to have a lot more variability.
Long pieces of different paces.
Yeah, right. So, you know, you could be running downhill for 8 miles and running uphill for 8 miles, which can, again, can get into your head, especially, you know, when you flip around after having seen a great pace.
So for the fast people, what kind of pace differential, uphill versus downhill, just to give people a bit of a...
In the steep sections, you know, anywhere from the times that I've run it going uphill, you might be doing 7 minute miles, and down you're doing 6.
Yeah, so that's super fit, one of the fastest runners in Ironman, giving away a minute each direction.
Yeah.
So everybody else should have a multiplier to that, most likely.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to see a major delta. So if you're accustomed to running with heart rate, I would say that would be a pretty good indicator. One thing might be on the gradual downhills, you know, maybe you could sit a little bit under your heart rate target zones, just because of the eccentric load that you're going
to
get.
And another thing to bring into your training is the fact it's going to be, even on the same effort, it's going to be a variable paced marathon with a significant amount of downhill running. So you'll need, and it's not steep downhill. So it's, the idea is to be relaxed and smooth running downhill on a hard surface. And you can build that into some of your specific prep runs.
And
it will really benefit you here.
There's some semi-sharp sort of little turns, too. So, there, you know, and just to add to the eccentric stress, there's going to be periods where you're sort of turning 90 degrees and it could be quite congested.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how it's going to play out. I actually think Ironman usually does quite a good job with their logistics. So while on paper, I think this is going to be really congested, especially since they said it was the highest participant list of any race they've ever done anywhere. And then saying, okay, well, here's a bike path and we're going to run two loops in both directions on it sounds like a bad idea to me. However, they tend to pull things off even sometimes when you... So I'll wait till it's done to say whether it was truly... But there's no way you're not going to be in some situations, particularly in aid stations, where you know you're going to want to be aware of what you need, what's going on. People are going in both directions. And just be heads up about it. You're not going to have quite as much room as you might have in some races where you have full open roads and not overlapping.
And just thinking about your preps, your runs. If you have something that's like a railway grade, where you can do, I don't know, 4 to 7 miles one direction, slightly uphill, 4 to 7 miles the other direction, slightly downhill. That type of running would be very specific to what you're going to face on the course. And I always like that type of running because on your easier days, you can still do, depending on your level, like an 8 to 15 mile run, which would be a moderately long run. And you can go on effort, aerobic effort on the way up. And you can go on pace on the way down. And if you translate that into what you're going to be doing on Ironman race day, you can have a very specific workout that doesn't generate a lot of fatigue. And we use that here. We've got something called Switzerland Trail. And I used to do a lot of training up there of that type of workout. And it worked really well for what you're going to face here in Boulder.
Yeah. I think it will be an interesting run course in that sense. It's really going to come down to that second uphill stretch. Being strong in the race is really already going to be more challenging.
And that's a great point. Get to where, you know, if you're going for a Kona slot, you got to get to where you need to be, mile 18 or 20. It's going to be tough to reel in people in that, you know, in that downhill finish. You're going to need to make it happen kind of two-thirds of the way through.
And on that note, in 3 weeks' time, about 3.5 weeks' time, we'll have a training camp on the course, June 20th to 22nd, and we'll incorporate the entire bike course on Saturday. And then the master's program is hosting an open-water swim race in the reservoir that has 1 and 2 mile options. So you'll get it won't be laid out exactly the way, but you'll get to be at the reservoir. You'll get to see how it feels to do a race, bring your wetsuits, do the whole thing. And then afterwards, we'll do a long run on the run course, and we'll vary the distance based on what people need to do for their training. And so that can be a great weekend to come out and check it out, particularly if, like Gordo was saying earlier, you don't have the opportunity to actually fully acclimate. This will give you the opportunity to get some feedback on what will lead to your most effective race based on the travel plan that you can incorporate into your training and this event. And with that, we will be signing off. Thanks for listening.